I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company from the Archives. Today, to celebrate St. Patrick's Day, four Irish writers talk about home and away. Michael Collins, Claire Keegan, Colin McCann, and Nuala O'Fuaillean. In 2003, at the Victoria Literary Arts Festival, a packed house, more than 400 people jammed into the conference center to hear new and established Irish voices. Three still in their 30s, two of these living in the United States for half their lives, all of them from the Republic in the South, but not really agreeing about much. Michael Collins was born in Limerick in 1964, the great-grandson of the Irish freedom fighter Michael Collins. In the early 1970s, his family moved to Dublin. Almost from the beginning, Collins was a remarkable athlete. In his late teens, he won a scholarship as a cross-country runner at Notre Dame University in the United States, and he's lived in the U.S. more or less ever since. After college, he took a job with Merrill Lynch as a computer analyst. Then he traveled around Europe, started writing, and returned to Notre Dame, but this time in the creative writing program. In 1991, his MA thesis became his first book of stories. For most of his adult life, Michael Collins has combined three enthusiasms: extreme sports, computers, for a while he was also working for Microsoft, and writing. Writing seems to be in the ascendant if you don't count the Himalayan ultramarathon 100-mile race at altitude starting at 14,000 feet. The danger, he said after he'd won, is that you can develop a clot in your brain from lack of oxygen. Collins is the author of 10 works of fiction which have been translated into 20 languages. His third novel, The Keepers of Truth, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and his most recent novel is The New Existence. He currently lives in South Bend, Indiana. Claire Keegan was born in 1968, the youngest of six children. She grew up on a 53-acre farm in County Wicklow, Ireland. When she was 17, she left for the U.S. and university in New Orleans. Later, she got two master's degrees, in creative writing at the University of Wales in Cardiff, and a master's in philosophy from University College Dublin. Her first book of stories, Antarctica, won many awards, including the William Trevor Prize. When we met in 2003, I knew from the beginning that hers was an original voice, quiet, compelling. As the UK's Guardian newspaper put it, a new Claire Keegan book is as rare and precious as a diamond in a coal mine. Small, sharp, and brilliant. There have been only four books in the last 20-odd years. After Antarctica came Walk the Blue Fields, then a standalone long story, Foster, which was made into an Irish-language feature film called The Quiet Girl. Claire Keegan's 2020 novella, Small Things Like These, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and it's recently been made into a movie starring Emily Watson and Oscar winner Cillian Murphy. Last year, she won Author of the Year at the Irish Book Awards. Her latest collection is called So Late in the Day, Stories of Women and Men. Colin McCann was born in 1965 in Dean's Grange, South County, Dublin, where he studied journalism. He worked in New York and Dublin, and then when he was 21, he went back to the United States. He traveled around the country on a bicycle for a couple of years, then studied English at the University of Texas in Austin. Colin McCann has lived in New York for more than two decades. At the time of the panel in Victoria, he'd written three novels and two books of stories, including Everything in This Country Must, which is about Northern Ireland. His breakout success, Let the Great World Spin, came in 2009. McCann was the first Irish-born writer to win the U.S. National Book Award. His novel also went on to win the 100,000 euro International Dublin Impact Award, and more. His latest bestseller is 2020's A Paragon, a book he calls a hybrid novel based on the true life friendship of two men whose daughters were killed in the Middle East. Nuala O'Fuaillean was born in 1940, the second of nine children, and grew up in County Dublin. She won scholarships to University College Dublin and to Oxford. Then she worked as a television producer for the BBC and for Irish Television. For many years, she wrote a popular column for the Irish Times. In 1996, when an editor suggested putting together a collection of these pieces, she offered to write an introduction. That famously became Are You Somebody?, the accidental memoir of a Dublin woman. The book had enormous success both in Ireland and in North America. O'Fuaillean took a leave from the Irish Times and wrote her first novel, My Dream of You, and then another memoir called Almost There, The Onward Journey of a Dublin Woman. At the time of our event in 2003, Nuala O'Fuaillean was living in County Clare in the west of Ireland and in New York. She died 5 years later, in May 2008. She was 68. Here they all are, on stage at the Literary Arts Festival in Victoria in 2003.
When I say the word Ireland, what does that conjure up for you? Taste, smells, people?
Well, landscape. A rocky shore and wind, and a little bit of rain in the wind. And that's it. And I know it's a cliche to think of that, to think of the west of Ireland and all, but I do. I live on a muddy lane in the west of Ireland, very unpicturesque. And everybody that lives on the lane is having a feud with everybody else. And I was explaining to Colm, it's absolutely necessary that they absolutely hate each other's guts because it gets so depressing in the winter, so grey, so damp. Small farming is so boring, they're so bored with raising bullocks that if they didn't hate each other, they'd never get out of bed.
The answer to the question is Nuala O'Fuaillean.
Michael Collins.
For me, because I left when I was 16 illegally in 81, so to me it was Ireland was probably the place of lost dreams, part of that whole history of going back to the famine of immigrants. And so for my generation, you wouldn't finish school, you'd arrive at 15, 16 with a sense of consciousness of who and what you were, but it wasn't going to be in Ireland. So I used to say that we didn't legalize abortion, but you had abortions when you were 16 or 17, and it was, you know, to get out of Ireland. And I arrived in the fortunate circumstances that we came to America in the early 80s, where you couldn't go there illegally. So it was sort of a double speak as well, that there was these dreams that Irish Americans had achieved. And for us, going there illegally, of course, there was an awful lot. It was a limited opportunity. So it really was, for me, a kind of shouting back at the country and saying, you know, things have changed. Why do the dreams, why does the myth go on?
Claire Keegan.
Well, I'd have to say it's something to do with grass. And damp. The grass was always damp, and everybody was always afraid of the grass, because you'd lie in it or you'd sit on it. So it all really goes back to that, and also some kind of an image about a pair of gates that most of the time were closed. And I don't know why that is, but it's something to do with that. And also, of course, what Nuala says about people having to hate one another, otherwise there'd be no crack at all.
I want to ask sort of a somewhat difficult or a slippery question. Is that how would you define Irish writing? I mean, what is it that gives Ireland a national literature? And I'll ask Colm.
I don't know if there's any one answer to that. There's a series of different answers that we could go on all night, but we'd have to end up in the pub later on talking about them all. But essentially it comes back to the old tradition of telling a story and having a deep need to tell a story.
A gentleman who was here earlier today came up to me and reminded me that Brendan Behan said, writers are failed talkers.
Why do you think the Irish in particular seem to have a deep need to tell a story?
I don't know, but I was just thinking whether there is an Irishness of writing anymore. Like, for a long time, what Irishness was defined by not being Englishness. And I'm very happy, for example, that my axis is Dublin, New York, because I can't stand the English, actually. Not any individual English person, but just them all together. But and I'm a complete failure in England and have sold in literally a handful of books and nobody wants to interview me or anything. But Colm's new book, Dancer, went to number one in England and he's a huge success in England. Like, we're as Irish as each other. His father was my father's boss. But it doesn't make any difference much anymore where you're from as a writer, I don't think, you know? And I'm much more sure I'm a woman than that I'm Irish. Mm. Like, I'm pretty rocky about both, but...
Irish literature question over to Claire.
Well, I think it's something to do with a love of gossip, begrudgery, humour, and bitterness. And I do think that there's a contentious nature that's genetic and rebellious, and it just makes for good fiction. But again, that comes down to language and the music of the language. And I understand Irish people best when we're dancing.
I was listening to Louis de Bernier last night, reading a charming story that basically is dependent on class, on the frisson of that the man who's losing his memory is a general, with the politeness and the manners of the British upper class. And I was thinking that, like, one of the things about Irish writing is it doesn't in any way rely on those frissons about class. And equally, up to quite recently, it couldn't have all those plots about adultery and all that Canadian writers have. On account of we didn't have any. You know? Hardly any. Because there wasn't any divorce until the other day, practically. So we've been stuck with narratives about the family, you know. Now, since they were all by fellas, they were about fellas growing up in the family. They, in other words, we have had a plethora of coming-of-age male writings, you know, beginning with the great man himself and Portrait of the Artist. But it's all broken up in the last 10 years, and now people like this young man over here, Miss Keegan, you know, have taken the ball and run away with it. Mm. And we've run right out into the modern world. And we're all hopping around continents on cheapish flights. Isn't that true?
Which is sort of a dangerous place to be, because when a country develops that sort of confidence, the need for stories changes. And we're at a very interesting time right now where there is a sort of arrogance. And we could talk about this, but personally I would say there is a sort of arrogance at home that says, you know, we're Irish, we're European, we own the world. The country is in a sort of delayed adolescence, I find.
I'm interested, Colm, about this the arrogance. What is that about?
Well, I find a sort of... I was talking earlier with somebody today about this sort of disease of cafe mochas and traffic and people talking about their mortgages. And, like, you went to a pub in Dublin and... you know, four fellas go into a pub and there's five mobile phones go down on the table and everybody's talking about where they should be rather than where they are. And so the nature of storytelling gets changed and so on. You know, it's maybe easy for me because I'm living away to say these sort of things.
One characteristic of Irish writers and the Irish in general is to emigrate. The Irish have always been good at leaving home, and there's a great literary tradition with Joyce and Beckett. In earlier generations, censorship and poverty were in part what drove Irish writers out of Ireland. But now, with the current prosperity, many are still leaving. Nuala, why do you think that is?
I don't know. I'm trying to write a novel about what coming to America does to a middle-aged woman. Needless to say, nothing to do with me or anything. I'm trying to imagine it, but I know this. The North America, because I count Canada in this, and Ireland are very different places spiritually. Even though they may seem so alike, with the same television and food and language and so on, they're not at all alike. And I, for one, I'm very interested in the degree of lively rancor in Irish life, the vitality of malice in it, and the comparative sweetness of ordinary dealings between people in North America, the generosity of the way people look at each other here and give each other the benefit of the doubt, and how less judgmental they are here.
All of you have lived in the United States for certain periods of your life, and Colm, you've talked about the American wake.
Yeah, I think Michael and I were among, we were part of a generation that was almost the last to emigrate. I don't think emigration exists in the same way for Irish people anymore as it did for the last 150 years. It used to be that when you emigrated, some people will know this, but you'd have an Irish wake, which means basically that they would have a party for you. They would have your wake, and they would have your funeral, if you will, but there'd be one extra person there. And people would gather, and then you would go off the next morning on the ship, and you knew that you weren't coming home. It was very, very poignant. And in fact, young women sometimes used to unravel balls of wool and then have their mothers or fathers hold it on the shore. And then they would gather up that wool after it had been soaked in the ocean and carry it with them across to the States and then create a garment of clothing that they would wear forever. There are all these poignant things. There's no poignancy and no need for such poignancy anymore when we have a sort of what Joe O'Connor calls a commuter generation. Because I can be in Dublin from New York in 7 hours, but it'd take me 24 hours to drive from Kerry, given the traffic nowadays. You know? No, it's just become smaller and it's become different. And because of the prosperity and so on, you don't emigrate for the same reasons. I left because I was curious. And I'd been reading Kerouac and Ferlinghetti and Burroughs. And I wanted to see this sort of mythical land. But others left because they had to.
You have a reading for us from your book of stories, Fishing the Slow Black River.
Yeah, this is a story about emigration. It's sort of a magic realist story. It's one of the very first stories I wrote. And I say it's magic realist in that it's about women fishing for their gone children. The reason I wrote that story was because I had a dream about my mother. And there were times when she was very sad about her sons being away. And I had a dream one night about her fishing for myself and my brother. It's called Fishing the Slow Black River. The women fished for their sons in the slow black river that ran through the small Westmead town, while the fathers played football without their sons in a field half a mile away. Low shouts drifted, lazy swallows, over the river, interrupting the silence of the women. They were casting with ferocious hope, 26 of them in unison, in a straight line along the muddy side of a low-slung river wall, whipping back the rods over their shoulders. Mrs. Conheeny wore a headscarf patterned with corgi dogs, the little animals yelping at the side of her ashy hair. She bent her back into the familiar work of reeling in the empty line. Each time she cast, she curled her upper lip, scrunching the crevices around her cheeks. She was wondering how Father Marsh, the old priest for whom she did the housekeeping, was doing as goalkeeper. The joke around town was that he was only good for saving souls. As she spun a little line out from the reel, she worried that her husband, at right half back, might be feeling the ache in his knee from ligaments torn long ago. Heavy roars keened through the air as the evening stole shapes. Each time the women heard the whistle blow, they raised their heads in the hope that the match was finished so they could unsnap the rods and bend towards home with their picnic baskets. Mrs. Conheeny watched Mrs. Hines across the river, her face plastered with makeup, tentatively clawing at a reel. Mrs. King was there with her graphite rod. Mrs. O'Shaughnessy was whipping away with a long, slender piece of bamboo. Did she think she was fishing in the Mississippi? Mrs. Bergen, her face in pain from the arthritis, was hoping her fingers might move a little better like they used to do on an antique accordion. Further down along the pebble-dashed wall, Mrs. McCartan was gently humming a bit of a song. Her husband captained the team, a barrel of a man who, when he was young, consistently scored a hat-trick. But the team hadn't won a game in 2 years, ever since their children had begun their drift. They waited, the women, and they cast, all of them together. When the long whistle finally cut through the air and the colours took on forms that flung themselves against the northern sky, the women slowly unsnapped their rods and placed the hooks in the lowest eyes. They looked at each other and nodded sadly. Another useless day fishing. Their husbands arrived with their amber jerseys splattered with mud, their faces long in another defeat. Mrs. Conheeny readjusted her scarf and watched for her husband's car. She saw him lean over and ritually open the door before he even stopped. "Any luck, love?" he asked. She shook her head. "I didn't even get a bite." She looked out to the slow black river as they drove off, then sighed. One day she would tell him how useless it all was, this fishing for sons. When the river looked not a bit like the Thames or the Darling or the Hudson or the Loire or even the Rhine itself, where their own three sons were working in a car factory. He slapped his hands on the steering wheel and said with a sad laugh, "Well, feck it all anyway. We really need some new blood in midfield." Although she knew that he too would go fishing that night, silently slipping out down to the river to cast in vain.
Thank you.
Colin McCann reading the title story from his book, Fishing the Slow Black River. Nuala, what first took you to the United States?
Just about Colin's story first, you know, I remember the impact of reading it, but I'd forgotten the detail of it. And it's so brilliant, the innocence of the men playing football. And the poignancy of the women. It's a brilliant story, it really is. And even though it's impossible to say in a programmatic way what it's about, like, you know what it's about, and that's what it's about, is pointless family love broken by the pressure that took the kids away. I often think that the savagery of Irish family life, the cruelty to children, really was a preemptive strike against the fact that they were all going to go anyway. Because until quite recently, one in every two of every children born in Ireland left. So that's a very defining experience. But as for myself, I did various emigrations when I was young, just as a, you know, just as a member of the underneath of the proletariat working in England, never dreaming that there'd be a different future for me than to be in this factory or something, because I'd failed to get through college, you know. I was drinking and I lost my money and everything, you know. But then my happy emigration started a few years ago. I was working for the Irish Times in 1998. The editor asked me to go to the north of Ireland for a year. He said things were getting normal up there. And that... So I moved to Belfast, where I completely failed to find anything to write a normal column about, because I didn't know enough about the norm. Well, it isn't very normal anyway. And nobody will talk to you. That's the main thing. They won't even say hello, like, in case it can be misinterpreted. So, but I did it for 8 months. And during that 8 months, my little memoir, Are You Somebody?, came out in America. And I was sent on a four-city tour. And believe me, I thought it was the most wonderful thing that ever happened. Limitless room service, you know. And never meeting anyone except people who are interested in you. Yeah. So So I went back from that four-city tour to Belfast, and I thought, here, come here. This is ridiculous. So I asked the editor, I did. I said to him, can I have unpaid leave, indefinite unpaid leave? I'm going to go to America to try to write a novel. And I did. I went to New York where I knew nobody, and I got a room, a very cheap room behind a Mexican restaurant. And at a certain point, I started the first bit of this novel I was trying to write, and I wrote, and I hope yous are all literate enough to know what it means. At the top, I wrote A-M-D-G. Do you remember that? No. Ad maiorem Dei gloriam, to the greater glory of God. Not because I particularly believe that there's a God who cares whether I'm writing a novel or not, but because I was saying this is a solemn undertaking. And that's why I've moved from everywhere I know and everything I know to sit in this miserable kip of a room until something happens. And I did, and it did. And
but
it took
but
2 years.
You said you'd never have tried writing fiction in Ireland.
Not one.
Why?
Because I was already saying what I knew they'd say. You know, will you look at her cashing in, you know? I suppose she thinks she can write a novel. I had all my things in my head. I had my own excuses made, but you move to New York or to one of the great Canadian cities or any of those, or San Francisco or Boston, what are they made of but people who came there to do something they couldn't do at home? What are they made of but hope and optimism? Like, the place, these cities, these North American cities are about self-transformation. And so that's the place to go if you're nearly 60 and you're trying to do something that, as far as you know, you can't do.
Have you ever longed to escape reality or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
Claire Keegan, you've also spent time in the U.S., especially at Loyola University in New Orleans. Some of your stories are set in the United States. What's the attraction for you?
Well, for me, when I was 17, it was getting away. It's just, I hated home. And I wanted to be elsewhere. And it wasn't particularly an attraction to the States. It was just that an opportunity came up when I was 16. And I just, at the time, instead of going to school, I was sleeping in hay sheds or the forest. And really, it was a very sad kind of a time. And I didn't tell anybody. And I remember going into school one day, and it was shortly after a woman called Anne Lovett died. And she was a very young woman, much the same age as I was then. And she died having a baby because she wouldn't tell anybody that she was pregnant. And she actually fooled the community and her parents into thinking she wasn't pregnant, and she actually died having this baby. And I went into school about, I don't know, 4 days after that, and the principal, Mr. Finlayson, says, I know what's going to happen to you. You're going to wind up just like Anne Lovett. And I thought, I hate this country. America, roll on.
You're all originally from the Republic of Ireland, but I was wondering how much the troubles in the Northern Ireland have affect your work. Colm McCann, your mother's family's from County Derry in Northern Ireland, and I was reading somewhere how you go back there every year. What influence has that had, do you think?
I think it's amazingly important, and I think, I don't think that there's any one thing that writers should have to write about, but I think to a large extent, a lot of writers from the Republic, from the South, don't write about Northern Ireland, and I don't really understand that, since it's, from Dublin to Belfast is 103 miles, and that's hardly any distance at all. And surely the temperature of everywhere where we are in the south is influenced by the temperature of the north, and vice versa. And so I think it's an important story. I think it's been written quite well by the poets, but I think it's very important. I think it's very important to talk about it. I do find, I don't know, Nuala or Claire or Michael, if you'd agree with me, that in the south people don't like to talk about the north.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
Why do you think that is?
The north for us was the draft coming in under the door. It was the thing on the TV that you wanted to be over so you could get onto local news and get the weather. But it was always there, and because it was never spoken of, it actually gave it more power for me as a writer now. And yes, I would be wary as a writer to write about it because I have a fear of not knowing the language, of not knowing enough, of just having that outsider's view.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, for me, down around Limerick, there's so many IRA cells, and as I was growing up, you know, as bombs went off, it was often traced back down to that area. So, you know, I never heard anyone really speak about the troubles or discuss them in terms of what we should do. But there's all these clandestine operations at play. But one of the other things was this this notion that sometimes you'd look on the news or you'd hear a story that someone had actually participated, someone's father, in a bomb up in the north. And then to, you know, for it just to sort of exist in this rumour and, you know, in schoolboy, in the toilets and that, to hear this, and to think that the war was actually being waged, more or less not in Dublin or further up, but a lot of times down around Cork and Limerick. I mean, that's where the Michael Collins, who I'm related to, I mean, they came out of that area deep down in the south where the English had a hard time getting to us, and it lived on there. And I remember, you know, the profound effect of the hunger strike as well on all of us. And why I think the reason we don't ever speak about it is because there was no possible way as we as a nation could go up there and do something about it. The minute you try to send people up there to have a fight, we'd just be slaughtered. But it sort of lives, it exists at this other level. And
but
I think
then the lack of a sort of truth and reconciliation committee, even on a metaphorical level, is one of the things that blocks us from access to a greater kind of peace. And I think that there should be more talk about it, and there should be more writing, because we write towards what we want to know rather than necessarily writing exactly what we do know.
Yeah, Nuala, you were talking about how you were posted to Belfast to write about ostensible normalcy.
I'm not talking on the level, Colin's talking on the level of a writerly imagination, but just as a journalist, I worked in Irish television and then in the Irish Times, I know that the main feeling of the South about the North for a long time now has been sort of more or less anguished impatience. That first of all, we don't really understand. That secondly, we can't really do anything about it. That thirdly, we're stuck with it. That fourthly, we're mixed up in it in some obscure way. That fifthly, everybody in the North manages to look down on the South. I mean, the loyalists look down on us, obviously, because we're Catholics and so on, but the Catholics look down on us because we're not more upset about the whole thing. The Irish-Americans look down on us because we haven't helped to liberate the flipping North, because, of course, liberating the North is a much more complex matter than marching up there with a green flag. And when I went and lived there, what's evident to me is it is an utterly different place from the South. It's popular culture faces England. It's about ITV television stars and it's about things like that. It's completely different. We split apart in the early 1920s, and the six counties has developed and evolved in its way, and we have developed and evolved in our way, and we're yoked together on the one island, but without much mutual understanding or mutual love.
But in defence of that, I have to say that I love the people from the north, and I find them more open in many, many ways. Well, I am nuts.
I mean, I think the place is rotten with bigotry, so I do.
Oh, it is, yeah.
Well, so is the South.
Look at what's happening in the South. If you're Nigerian
don't
or
make a right. Huh? Let's talk about the North of Ireland. Mm. They hate each other, right? Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't really matter because the Good Friday Agreement is such a brilliant piece of civil service and diplomatic architecture that they're going to have to live together in greater and greater peace.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean to say they like each other.
Yeah. Oh, no, I never claimed that they necessarily liked one another, no. But I found a good spirit there. I found.
So did I. I was once on Good Morning America on St. Patrick's Day, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, loads of big black policemen in green wigs and little girls in kilts and bagpipes and, oh, ask me, mayhem. And I was on a little sofa with Frank McCourt, who I'd never met before. And in the middle of everybody, you know, doing Paddy's Day things, the man leaned over to Frank McCourt and he said, Frank, could you explain to us, you Irish are such beautiful people, why do you fight with each other? And Frank said, don't ask me, ask her, she's living there. Me. And I said, listen, America, the North America's full of people who don't like each other. Do you think they like each other? I could think of loads of examples, but I didn't give them. North America's full of people who loathe each other. But they've all got some kind of sense that they're protected in the long run. You know, that there's jobs out there and that there's courts and that there's the Supreme Court and somebody's going to look after them. I said, all you need is institutions that everybody agrees on. They don't have to like each other, people. Oh, yeah, he said, yeah. And they cut away. That was it all fixed. Yeah.
I'd like to look for a moment at the tradition of writing in Ireland and what led to where Irish writing is today. I think, to start with, I would guess that Ireland has more Nobel Prizes per capita than any other country. There's Yeats, Shaw, Beckett, Seamus Heaney. Michael, why do you think writing is so much a part of Ireland?
Oh, I think people who are poor, I mean, you can't paint, you can't do sculpture. I mean, it really was the written word is the poor man's way of probably expressing himself. I also know that growing up around Limerick, there was a conscious effort on the part of the communities to actually have writing prizes for young kids. So actually, you know, years ago won the milk board prize for, I don't know, something about milk. And I got a fishing rod. And I thought, you know, I mean, for years, like even as I went to America, I thought one of the great things I did was win the fishing rod. So they've had inbred that into us, the notion of how can you express yourself and given these prizes, just like Romanians, you know, you do backflips. But in Ireland, there is that reverence for the story. So I think you know, that's lives with us. And of course, then with the Joyce and Beckett, especially for my generation, it really, be it a myth. I mean, I don't think everyone walks around thinking they're a writer, but it even got into our consciousness that Joyce and Beckett lived and that a reputation was as wordsmiths and as writers. And I think everyone in Ireland is trying to write a book these days based on that.
This eloquence that's so valued in Ireland, really valued and admired and liked, somebody like, it might be the postman in the village is really good at talking, you know, and that's real status. But this eloquence is all on the public social level. In private, it's the most tongue-tied and fearful of cultures, and the words of love and tenderness and so on are feared, and very little is used. There are such silences, and any remedial teachers or anyone, people who visit the picturesque-looking farms up the Boreens and so on, they'll come on families that really communicate by grunts, you know? And yet these same people in the pub might be marvellous talkers, you know?
That's very true.
So, you know, I'm telling you, I'm going back to my Ireland-America thing. America doesn't make such a show, far from it. I'm always kvetching about how boring Americans are in the way they talk. But nevertheless, what they say, they mean, you know? Whereas I doubt whether any of us have said anything tonight that we...
It is sad about not being able to say I love you. I mean, when I was younger, I would just, you know, leave. But these days, when I go back and see my parents, they're getting on. And a lot of times my mother, you know, you have to get the flight really early at, you know, 6 or something in the morning. And so she's not out of bed or something. But you go in and just start to shake her hand. And, you know, like one of these days, you'll just get the phone call and you have to come rushing back for Seattle to bury her. But I can never, because we had an American cousin who came over and hugged her once. And she's still, like, kind of...
Yeah.
The guy who hugged me. So it's just like, all right, I'll see you, Mom.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just can't break that down.
Yeah?
Yeah, my parents never told me that they loved me, even though I knew that they did. And it wasn't until my kids just constantly started telling them, Nana and Pops, I love you, that I heard them say, I love you. But I remember things like such tenderness. In my father grows roses, and my sister, this is only last year, my sister's in her 40s, and she was cutting away at some of the roses, and she pricked her finger, and he went to get the thorn out, and he pushed her finger and was holding her finger, and then a little bit of blood came out, and he picked up her finger, and he sucked the blood from her finger. Aww. And I thought, how amazing is that? What sort of that? That's real deep, deep love. But that same man never told us that that he loved us. But I knew
and
he loved us.
Here.
I knew he loved. I mean, it's yeah. not. It's
and
not,
they end
not
every phone conversation, love ya. Yeah. And the word is so powerful that it makes your heart go yeah. boom, yeah. you know, and you think they throw it around, you know.
Yeah.
And then I think, well, better to throw it around than to hoard it.
Yeah, I don't know.
But best,
but sometimes
best of all,
there's
the
subtleties of nuances of if you can't use it to try and impart love. And I mean, if that isn't available in your language, then like Colm's story there, I mean, it manifests itself. I mean, it's not a nation of maniacs. So that love does percolate through this. But, so you see it in these moments like that, and you know, I think they resonate a lot more than I love you all the time. Mm. So, I mean, yeah. I think that's part of the font of being an Irish writer, or is that there is that level of which we're not allowed to talk about. And a lot of times in your stories or whatever, is you're trying to go down to this other domain where you tap into the unspoken language that's in the culture. I mean, if the other language is just not available, you as a writer need to say, here's the subtext and here's what people wanted to say, and use a subterfuge so that they don't run around and start hugging each other, but somehow come up with the metaphors and the images that show you that there is a life and a love there. And I think that's the kind of profound thing, is that you leave Ireland with anger and pain and a variety of other things. But anyway, you just come back and you're just trying to find where is the goodness, where is the grace in it. And I think that's why I write anyway, is that you go back and just say, look for these metaphors, look for these images that do tap into what's great about the country.
Women in Ireland have gained more autonomy in the last 30 years since Ireland became part of the European Union and since there's been greater prosperity. Claire Keegan and Nuala O'Fuaillean, you've both written about the oppressive circumstances that Irish women have often found themselves in. Claire, how has that changed?
I think it's just, there is no comparison between my mother's life and mine. I think it is startling. I think it's frightening for men, and I understand that. And I think that men are left with not knowing what to do to some extent. But I mean, for the women, it's just, in the 1970s in Ireland, if you had a civil service job, if you worked for the government, you were required, if you got married, to give up your job. That's not long ago.
Yeah, in the 1970s, when I was very much a grown woman, any form of contraception or family planning, apart from the so-called natural method, was not allowed. It was, in fact, criminal. And you weren't allowed to know that it existed. So that if, for example, you were a subscriber to, let's say, The Nation or Ms., grown men, the customs officers, were employed to tear out the pages at the back with the small ads. And that was their job, while women with minds and hearts and souls were there. And the job was to stop women knowing that. And nobody thought it was odd. Mm. Nobody thought it was odd that the one and only social welfare payment, the children's allowance, was paid to the man as the head of the household. Nobody thought it was odd that though legally women could serve on juries, they had not served on juries. No woman had served in a jury for 60 years. This was in the 1970s. Mm. So believe me that the women's movement was worth having in Ireland because there was nowhere to go but up. And it mattered terribly. It was the movement for civil rights in the Republic of Ireland, but that, I don't think, was felt as such by more than a few men, all of them young. And so much so that when the Field Day Anthology of Irish Literature, a massive and impressive three-volume endeavour edited by Seamus Dean, was brought out, there was nothing, there was not a single mention of the one true revolution of the 20th century, which is the one Claire's referring to, that our lives of our grandmothers are utterly overturned, and that it is... That has been the big thing that happened in Ireland. But they're so hung up on politics and military history that they despise social history if it has, because it's only to do with women. But that's what really happened in Ireland this century, was what happened to women. Too late for me, but ample time for Claire to have a great life.
Claire Keegan, some of your stories and your new novel feature women who are pushing the boundaries of their lives. And I wonder if you could read from the beginning of your novel, Salt, where a young woman chooses to marry a man against her father's wishes.
Okay. I married Billy Fennell in a cold lambing season. Before I reached the chapel, snow was falling. And while we stood at the altar, taking our vows, I knew the snow would last. I was glad to be married, and I didn't mind about the weather. We walked across the Slaney Bridge to the hotel and ate roast beef and cabbage and watched the birds panicking on the lawn. Nobody came to our wedding. Our marriage was witnessed by a cousin of Billy's who owned the sweet shop next to the chapel gates and a layman from the boarding school who read the lesson. My father did not approve of me marrying Billy. He would not say why. And my mother was dead. Billy's father was in bed with pleurisy the day we married, and his mother was in a nursing home in Baltinglass. He had no siblings, and I had only the one brother who went off to England shortly after my mother's funeral, and I hadn't seen him since. I come from people who are distant, but Billy wasn't like that. I knew that if I died, Billy Fennell would eat me sooner than bury me. When I first saw Billy, I was leading my father's brood mare around a ring at the Tinnahealy show. Billy stared. He wasn't afraid to stare. He came over and asked me about her pedigree and took me into the tent for tea. I had a great appetite that never stuck to my bones. I ate four ham sandwiches with mustard, and then he bought me a white geranium at the ICA stand, and we went to look at the poultry. I was thinking about rearing turkeys and selling them for Christmas. But my father turned pale and bade me to load up the mare and come home. "Don't you know we're late for the milking as it is?" he said when he got me in the car, but it wasn't true. When we got back to the yard, the cows hadn't even come down as far as the Ponfield gate. And Billy wrote shortly after asking to see me, and I made the mistake of showing this to my father, who said I was going nowhere with anybody. And Billy wrote back and said he'd wait and that I'd come of age. And when the 2 years passed, I met him every Friday at the end of the avenue, because my father forbade him to set foot in the land, but we didn't care. Rain or thunder, I walked that road on a Friday, and rain or thunder, Billy's car was parked at the end of that road, and in fact, I preferred rain and thunder. And those nights when we'd drive out to Cahor and watch the sea going mad and talk about the past until it grew dark. Billy was a big man, with long arms, and his voice was hill water running over stones. Sometimes when we were courting, I closed my eyes, and I imagined him asking me if I had shut the hen house door or if there was a clean shirt in the house. After 2 years of courtship that began and ended at the foot of my father's avenue, I married this plain-spoken man and went to live with him on the back of Mount Leinster. My name was Rose Tyrrell before I married. I was 23 years old and Billy was almost 30. Neither one of us believed in God. We believed in land and trees. We believed in ghosts and the things that can't be named. And neither one of us took the sun's rising or rainfall for granted. I'll leave it there.
Wow.
Claire Keegan reading from her novel, Salt. We still hear about the American dream, and some of you have written about it or about its flip side. Is there an Irish dream today, do you think?
Oh, I think there is an Irish dream. And I think it's what we saw as the American dream.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a big car and a big house and a lawn and a fence around it and your children booked in. This is incredible to me. People are booking in their place for play school for kids now in Ireland to get them into the right school. It's almost like
Manhattan.
It's the chaos. And what was wild about us, which I think is what is good about us as well as bad about us, is just leaving us, and it frightens me. But yeah, I think that's what the dream is. Just get as much as you can, as show as you can.
That's not much of a dream, though. I was thinking of the word dream in a different way.
It could be a great country. There's only 3.5 million people in it. It's got money now. They're full of very clever, watchful people, like people on the edge of empire always are. Every single problem in Ireland is manageable. Homeless boiled down to a few thousand, you know what I mean? There's something that can be done. It is possible that with patience and vision that Ireland could be a really wonderful country. That's what's so heartbreaking about it.
I'm so sad about the landscape because people build these houses like they're out of Dallas in places where the landscape used to hug these cottages and old stone farmhouses and so on. And now people are putting up like ducks in flight on top of their gate pillars and things like that. This is horrible.
Don't knock Dallas. We'd never have got divorced if it wasn't for Dallas.
Yeah. That's right.
Nulo Fuelen, Colin McCann, Claire Keegan, Michael Collins. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Nulo Fuelen on stage in Victoria in 2003. She died in 2008. She was 68. Some years ago, her selected journalism was published in paperback under the title A Radiant Life. Colin McCann has a new book coming out this month, American Mother, co-written with Diane Foley, mother of the American journalist James Foley, who was kidnapped in northern Syria in 2014 and murdered by ISIS. Claire Keegan's latest collection is So Late in the Day, Stories of Women and Men. And Michael Collins' most recent novel is The New Existence. Today's show was produced by Mary Stinson. The senior producer of Writers and Company is Sandra Rabinovich, with thanks to Katie Swales and Olivia Pascarelli. You can also hear us on our website. Just go to cbc.ca/writersandcompany. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Next week, from Libya and the UK, Anatomy of a Disappearance. A son's quest for his missing father is drawn from Hisham Mattar's own family story. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.